Today, we're going to talk about whether antibiotics make you a slower cyclist. We're also going to have, of course, we have Hannah Otto here. So we're going to get her tips on Leadville, how to go sub-9. Specifically, we have an athlete asking that question, but also quite a few other ones that we'll be able to learn a lot about ultra endurance stuff with. And we'll also be talking about whether you should be taking in protein when you ride. This is a common misunderstanding that we see across the board. So this is going to be a great one. We got Coach Chad with us. He's going to give us a lot of insight on all of this. And of course, Hannah Otto. So let's dig into Rob's question first. Rob says, I've recently had a shoulder replacement that got infected, and I've been on IV antibiotics and oral antibiotics for a total of 12 weeks. I've trained consistently throughout this process and gained zero fitness. Is this normal for training while using antibiotics? Chad, what say you? You take the lead on this one.
Okay. So let's see. Let me scroll down to the right notes. Rob, it looks like what you're talking about is effectively gut health. So whether you recognize it or not, this is a matter of gut interaction with your brain and with the rest of your body. So the questions that are on our minds would be, does gut health affect training adaptation? Does it affect performance? And new discovery-ish is, does it affect training motivation? And then just to cut to the chase, research says probably not, and possibly. And the reason probably, I mean, research is always probably or likely, never certain, but the reason possibly is motivation is a new topic, but more so all of these, anything we have gained, any insight we have gained into the effect of the gut on adaptation and performance and motivation are all studies that have been carried out in mice so far. So animal studies, while obviously, nothing that's going to directly transfer to humans, do provide foundation for further research, do say, well, we're similar biological systems. In a lot of cases, medications between animals and humans are exactly the same. Sometimes the direct effects are a bit different. Sometimes they're just the same. But in any case, it provides a little bit of insight into a biological system, which fuels the interest and perhaps the funding for further research so that we can see, does this apply to us as human beings, but more importantly for us as Trainer Road listeners and athletes, does it provide what we need as athletes, the information we need as athletes? So really simply, if we recognize that the health of our microbiomes, you know, basically the gut inhabitants, the microbial organisms that exist within there are influenced by a few things, but I think it's safe to assume that they're mostly influenced by diet and exercise. And then when it comes to antibiotics, the antibiotics actually destroy bacteria, right? I mean, this is what antibiotics do. And part of our gut flora is, in fact, bacterial. And in some cases, we can actually affect broad swaths of this bacterial composition. It's kind of in the same vein as chemotherapy or radiation therapy with cancer. I mean, we try to kill the bad stuff, but in doing so, kill a lot of the good stuff at the same time, and that carries consequences. So as we ingest antibiotics and, you know, with greater frequency, and I won't even get into the fact that – let's just leave that alone.
There's a rabbit hole there, Chad.
There totally is.
Nice jump right over that one.
yep. So what's occurring, though, is we're reducing species variety. We're potentially altering metabolic activity, and in some cases creating antibiotic-resistant organisms. And then when this happens in youngsters, even within the womb, we can predispose them to gastrointestinal, immunologic, neurocognitive conditions and disorders and all these things that can affect them later in life. Mm-hmm. This is all – I won't say old news, but this has been reported for quite some time now. And then some of the damage that is inflicted, some of it rebounds, but it takes quite a bit of time, and some of it is never quite the same again. So there's always a bit of a risk. You know, you got to take the bad with the good, as it were. And then when you're dealing with broad spectrum antibiotics, these are kind of the what's the war term, scorched earth idea, in that they wipe out many strains of gut bacteria. They're just not selective. It's just like hit everything, hit it hard, hope for the best. And when we do this, there's a disruption or a damage or what's commonly referred to as a dysbiosis of these metabolic interdependencies. So all these things that between all other parts of the body, brain included, things get just a little bit out of whack. And this has earned antibiotics the description or a label in more than one paper as major disruptors of the gut microbiota. Okay. So knowing this, it's kind of, it's kind of easy to see that because antibiotics impact our gut health, they're going to affect a lot of things. And amongst them is our immune response. And I think it's easy to lose sight of the fact that when we're talking immune response, we're often talking about training adaptation, because what is training but an insult to our homeostatic state? And we rebound from that. We adapt. And that is an immune response, one form of immune response. So antibiotic intake, gut health, immune response, these are all tightly coupled with, as you might understand or expect, athletic performance. And then to add to this, research is actually linked. And I don't want to – this isn't doom scrolling I'm not trying to bring up any considerations people haven't already made. I'm not trying to overly worry people. But there are studies that do link antibiotics to things like tendon issues, cartilage issues, decreased performance in a general sense, and a host of other things, things I'm not going to name because, again, it just puts it unnecessarily on people's radar. But the simple takeaway is that when you're dealing with a physician and you think that antibiotic prescription might be in order, do inform the physician that you are an athlete, that you at times are under heavy training loads. Maybe you're coming off of one. But in either case, apprise them of your situation as an athlete because it could influence the particular antibiotics that they choose to prescribe. Mm-hmm. So now if we move on to the link between gut health and human performance, what Rob's experiencing right now is representative of a theory that's termed the gut muscle axis hypothesis. So there being, I mean, we've heard the gut brain axis, and I think that's pretty much on everyone's radar by now. We've studied that there is interaction between the brain and the gut back and forth all the time. There may also be, and it looks like there is, a relation between the gut and the muscle specifically, but we could kind of step back a little bit and just look at it as the relationship between the gut and really human performance or exercise performance. And just what we've seen so far, what the research bears out so far, is that this hypothesis may hold promise. So it's going to be really interesting. And this is kind of the nature of things, but because this is such a I don't know if I should term it as an emergent science, but it is new on the spectrum. And everything that scientists, researchers are finding out was not known just a couple short years ago. So even the studies that I looked at, a handful of them were like 2019 and forward. And each of them said, we'll see what future research holds. So this is new territory. So everything we can infer at this point is, you know, very speculative in nature. A lot of the times conducted on animals, and just everything we put out here is informed by, you know, not the firmest basis at this point. So don't take anything as gospel here. But like I said, there's this gut muscle axis, and then at least as likely is this gut brain axis. And when we look at the fact that antibiotics, they actually affect amino absorption in the gut, this can lead to a production of particular hormones. In some cases, this is dopamine and serotonin, the things that affect the reward centers in the brain. And in doing so, this can indirectly or kind of directly hamper motivation. So it can affect your training motivation. And I don't think this is what's going on in Rob's case. And again, got to caveat all of this with the fact that these are studies in mice. They noticed in mice that there was a reduced voluntary behavior to exercise with reductions in their gut flora brought on by intake of antibiotics. But the good news is that at least with the studies in mice, it appears that training adaptation and performance are not affected. So, you know, whether or not that bears out in humans remains to be seen. And it does suggest that dietary changes can possibly affect motivation to train. So if motivation is a concern, gut is perhaps a consideration you should be making. So really all of this boils down to just a couple basic suggestions. First, that you adopt a new perspective, if this isn't your perspective already, that there are actually three components of an athlete's diet strategy. Whereas we used to look at things, or we still look at things, as fuel and perform. You know, fuel and perform, fuel and perform. We're just concerned with fueling the work necessary. Rather, maybe we should be viewing things in the context of protect, fuel, and perform. Consider the health of our guts in order to determine if any obvious dietary modifications are on the table, right? The food you eat, do they include probiotics and fermentable, soluble fibers? Kimchi, kefir. I mean, these aren't the solutions, but if these aren't part of your diet, why not give them a shot? Supplements that you're already ingesting, or supplements that maybe you could ingest that could improve the health of your gut. And then medications other than antibiotics, the obvious antibiotics that, again, either you're on or maybe should be on. I don't know. But really simply, it's just adopt a dietary philosophy that actually includes gut health considerations.
Hannah, have you – thanks, Chad, by the way, for all the research and relaying that in layman's terms to us. Hannah, have you experienced I'm sure you have, because I bet most listeners to this have experienced something similar. But you being a pro athlete, what's your approach with antibiotics?
Yeah, I definitely feel like I've experienced negative impacts from antibiotics. So it was really interesting to hear, Chad, what you have to say. And I feel like I have to ask, because – what I've always heard is that antibiotics can break down red blood cells. So surely I'm not the only person who's heard that. So I'm just curious if you can shed any light on that, whether that's true or not, or if you found that in your research at all.
No, I didn't come across that. But again, I looked at a handful of studies that were specific to performance. I wasn't looking at the other effects. If I didn't see in the title something about endurance performance or athletes, or I kind of moved on. So it's absolutely a possibility, but it's not something I'm familiar with.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's always been my approach with antibiotics is, again, like no studies, but that's what I've read when I've been prescribed antibiotics, felt that concern as an athlete of like, how will this affect me? And so my personal anecdote with this was actually, I was prescribed antibiotics before the national championship this past year. And I mean, long story short, national championship was at 10,000 feet. I felt like it just, the antibiotics just absolutely was a factor that tanked me. And looking back on that, doing my own mild research, I felt like a lot of it was due to potential red blood cell breakdown. And knowing that, and knowing that it can take, you know, 4 to 6 weeks for red blood cells to regenerate, it made sense that this was something that potentially I put my body through. So all of that to be said, that's not from a study that I've read. That's a large caveat, but that was a personal experience that I had that I felt backed up potential information that I'd read before.
And this was something I came across, have to consider the obvious that if you're on antibiotics, it's probably in response to the fact that you are illness, or you're experiencing illness, you're feel illness coming on, you're recovering from an injury or currently injured, all things that certainly impact your ability to perform. So it could be, you know, conflation of something that is obvious but somehow overlooked.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you said that, because that was something I wanted to make sure to point out with this as well, is if you need antibiotics, like if you genuinely need them, this is not a reason to not take them. And that was the experience that I had as well, is I knew going in to this that it could potentially hinder my performance, but I needed the antibiotics. And so health comes first always. And so this isn't a reason to not take the antibiotics. It's a reason to give yourself a little bit more grace and understanding while you go through that treatment.
Yeah, exactly. The last thing I want to do is put anybody off of antibiotics. They're a wonderful thing, and they're absolutely necessary in some situations and beneficial in a lot of situations, but they come with downsides. That's just the way it is. It's just how it works, unfortunately.
I've experienced the same thing just personally, and I know others that for some reason when they've taken antibiotics, they don't feel like – in fact, I may be wrong in this, but Nate, I believe, is one that I remember multiple times. He's like, yeah, I'm on antibiotics and now I'm training like crazy again and I'm feeling great. He's long covered his battles with sinus infections, chronic sinus infections, and how he's gone through the process of going to ENTs and getting multiple different procedures done to help that. And it seems like he's doing much better with it. But that was something I remember him saying, like, yeah, now that I'm on antibiotics, I can train again. I can do all this. And for some reason, it didn't seem to affect him. Whereas with me, if I take antibiotics, I kind of just know that, like, okay, I'm going to lose a lot of fitness and it'll take time to get it back. But, you know, at least I've got my health. And that's like the important thing. I don't jump at them early when you were talking about different procedures that we could do to be able to manage the whatever illness that I have. I benefit heavily from having a doctor who is an endurance athlete, and that doctor knows that. And as a result, he is kind of willing to bring out the other tools in the tool chest prior to that. But there have been many times when, you know, you have to do that, especially parents. You're probably in the thick of it right now with your kids and school and dealing with illness. So don't feel bad if you're doing this, because I have seen that narrative pushed that, like, you know, athletes shouldn't be taking antibiotics, that sort of thing. And we are not saying that. Prioritize your health and make sure that that's in a good place. But yeah, you just have to, like Chad said, set your expectations, right? To understand that that does affect fitness for sure.
And be patient with yourself, because regardless of exactly the mechanism by which antibiotics could be hindering your training, it's going to take some time to build that portion of your body back up. I imagine that would very much be the case, Chad, when you're talking about the gut and healthy bacteria and all of that, correct?
Yeah, there has to be a regenerative period,
yeah,
right? If you killed certain bacteria, and those were necessary bacteria, because again, some of the good goes with the bad in terms of cleaning up the bacteria, let's put it that way, at some point they have to regrow.
Yep. Yeah, that's just part of the process. So, and in terms of how long that will take, I can already see that question coming in. Like, how long should I expect? That's highly individually variable. It likely is not going to be consistent for a single individual as well. It's going to vary from one circumstance to another. So that's just the way it is. There's so many factors at play there, right, Chad?
If we just restricted it to diet and exercise, there are so many factors just encompassed within each of those broad topics.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Hannah, can I ask you really quick? Can we talk about your season? Because you won Leadville, which was just amazing. You raced all over the place. You had a season where you shared really openly on your Instagram channel. Everyone should go follow Hannah on Instagram. Just search for Hannah Otto. You'll find her on there. But Hannah, you've had a season where you've shared like a lot of struggles, but you've had like, I feel like it's a very polarized season of lows and highs, right? Where you've had both. What do you take looking back at your season? What are your main takeaways and learnings?
Oh my gosh. That's such a big question.
Yeah.
I mean, I think for better or for worse, there were a lot of lows and highs. And I think I can learn a lot from both of those. And I think, gosh, I think there's so many different ways to take that. But I think one of the takeaways is just to remain steady all throughout mentally and emotionally. And I mean that as in no low is the end of the world. And because there are a lot of times I think that it feels like whatever situation you're in is kind of the forever situation. And I learned very quickly this year that it's ever changing. And whatever situation you're in is sometimes all you can remember and feel. And when it's bad, that's really frustrating. And when it's really good, all of that bad immediately dissipates. And it's just really interesting to kind of look at that in retrospect. Because I don't remember those bads as much. Like when I think back on my season, I think about winning Leadville. And so I think it's just important to have that overarching narrative and then to take that as you go into each race and help that eliminate some of the pressure. Because that was a big learning experience for me as well, is that if I can be calmer and eliminate pressure and expectation, I have a lot more freedom to perform to my best potential. And so by understanding that every race isn't the be-all end-all, it helps eliminate some of that stress and pressure. And I think ultimately opens me up to have my best performances.
Did you feel a lot of pressure after winning Leadville? At your next races, did you feel like you had to live up to that? You had to replicate that performance?
You know, I didn't. I felt like it opened a different door for me. I felt like instead of feeling like I had to replicate it, I felt like instead I just carried a new sense of, you know what? I can win this race today. And I do know that as a fact because I've done it. Whether or not I do, who knows? But it was really empowering for me to have that win so that I could stand on those next few start lines just with that joy of like, it almost felt like a little like secret in my head of like, ooh, I could win this race, you know? And then only one person wins. And I think that was something really exciting about the Lifetime Grand Prix is a different woman won every single race.
It's crazy, huh?
Yeah. And so it's very competitive out there and you can't only have a win be the only thing that is success. Because if that was the case, everyone only succeeded one time in that series. And then many, many people would have succeeded zero. And that's simply not the case. And so I think that, yeah, it's a huge honor to stand on the start line knowing you can win, but releasing the fact that whether or not that plays out is fine. And it's checking off those all those goals in between.
Yeah, there's a big difference there between hope and belief, right? And that's like a leap that's really tough for a lot of athletes to make. And then let's scale that way back to all of us amateur athletes. It's the same thing. It's just different, right? Like the circumstances look similar, but they're just, you know, unique to ourselves. But there is a difference there, right, Chad? Like when you actually believe you can do whatever the goal is versus just hoping.
Belief has to have a basis in reality. So, I mean, you can hope all you want, but belief is based on something, not necessarily tangible, but something that something stronger than what hope's based on. So like Hannah said, she won an event and it's an amazing phenomenon that happens. And you see it all the time. You can watch a grand tour, you can watch it in your own experience, but you have that one little taste of success, that one little bit of evidence that says, oh, I can do this. I'm this good. I don't need to get lucky. I don't have to have the stars perfectly in alignment. I can win bike races because I do the work. Whatever. But the many reasons that add up to that one glimpse or taste of success that make you believe that you can do it again.
I think that's why it's really important to set those incremental goals that are a stretch, but they're achievable if you do the necessary work. And if you improve as you think that you can, and then when you make that step, you have belief and then you reach for another one and then they compound. And then that gets you to the point where you develop like almost a secondary belief that you know that you can take the next step, whatever that is, because you've got a track record of taking steps up from where you've come from. So,
and it has to loosen some mental reins too, because you can't watch it happen so frequently. One rider wins a stage of the Tour de France. And next thing you know, that rider who's never had a pro tour victory has now got two stages, three stages, is now in every breakaway because the belief is there.
Yeah. I think of Mark Hirschi from 3 years ago in the tour. I can't remember.
He's a perfect example.
Yeah. He like burst onto the scene with a win that seemed unlikely. And then thereafter just continued to replicate that. And then he struggled last year so hard.
It's a sad thing to watch that belief dismantled too, because for every win you get, every loss, I think has maybe not equal impact, but it definitely detracts from your belief. It starts to pull at it a little bit and makes you question, oh, was that a fluke? Was that a series of flukes? I mean, how could I have had this level of success and now I can't achieve anything near it? Yeah.
I think that's where people can get really mixed up in the winning process, because I know for me, my story in cycling has very much been one of incremental improvements. So when I was finishing in the 20s, improvement felt a lot wider because I could finish anywhere above 20th and it would count as success in my book. And as it got narrower and narrower, 10th, top five, then all of a sudden I had to be on the podium to achieve success. And now that I'm looking for wins, that is incredibly narrow. And so that's where I think it is important it's a difficult balance, because if you are a professional athlete, you have to want to win. You have to believe you can win, but you can't live and die by your wins. You have to be able to label more than that as success still.
Yeah, you almost have to recognize the reality of your circumstances, that you're playing thin odds, right? Like, even if you can win, you have a track record of winning, there are still many things that need to work out right in order for a win to happen. And particularly in the sort of racing that you're doing, Hannah, when you're dealing with group dynamics, with men and women also being racing together, because that introduces just a huge amount of variables that you can't control. You're on like a Big Sugar, the final race, you're dealing with rocks that like our actual knives and like all the dogs even on course. Like, oh, you had like crazy chaos. So it's, you're playing really thin odds. And I think that there's, so I've fallen victim before to eat at a very low scale of having success of like winning local races and suddenly feeling like, well, if I don't win every local race I'm in, then I'm regressing and then I'm falling back. But your perspective is a really good one in knowing that, hey, I can win and I'm here to do what I can to win. And when you approach it from that perspective, it's very different than saying I should win. That completely changes where your head's at.
And I think we too should mention the necessity of belief, because, you know, as I said, it's hard to have belief that you can win a race if you haven't won a race, but you can have some belief in yourself. Again, belief that I've done the training, that I've arrived on race day fully prepared, that I can do this. Because if that belief isn't present, you are not winning a race. You're just not going to outperform what you believe you can or cannot do. So at least allow yourself, regardless of your level of success in the past, to believe I can do this. I may not do it today, but I can do it. I've done everything necessary to put me in a position where I can do this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting that you have to deal with different circumstances and, quote, issues after winning, right? Like, you think that, oh, you've won, like, life's good, you know? But it's tricky. But great insight, Hannah. I like how you look at it. So
that's a tough one. There's nowhere to go but down, huh?
Yeah, that's one perspective, right? And then the other perspective is like, all right, I can be here. Like, I need to check the boxes and do my best, and I can be there, and we'll see if.
Or yet another perspective: I've done it. Now I can relax and just have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, good call. Jacob's question: hey, coaches, love the pod platform and everything in between. If you want to find out what Jacob's talking about, go to trainerroad.com and sign up. We would love to have you. It's the best way to get faster. You can have your best year yet. So go do it. He says, I think of all the discussions on sports psychology on the podcast have helped me more than anything in sport and life. Hopefully that one helped you too, Jacob, because that does not just apply to sport. That applies to life as well, what we covered there. I have a question for the team and a challenge for Nate. Nate's not here, so we'll just accept your challenge on behalf of Nate for you, because that's what we do. So one of the topics often discussed is fueling work. Nate has also discussed how fueling the work can lead to fitness improvements, which will lead to burning more calories on the bike over time. Lastly, Nate has also discussed his strategies for carb loading before a race, which Chad and I have physically witnessed and at times with mouths agape at what we're witnessing. So here is my question. What are the downsides to following the carb loading strategy at all times? When I carb load, my legs always feel incredible. I generally gain a bunch of water weight, but boy, can I put out the power on the bike. I can't help but wonder why I don't stuff my face with pancakes down or drowning in buckets of maple syrup every day if it will improve my fitness. Now, and then separately, and Hannah, I'm going to kick that one to you first, and then Chad, I want to get your thoughts. But then here's the challenge for Nate. He said, here's my challenge for Nate. Whenever he gets the bug to start biking again, I challenge him to eat like he is carb loading for the entirety of his first training block and see how it goes. I know he's enjoyed dedicating his body to experiments in the past, so I thought I would throw this one out there. Thanks again. He also had another challenge, and I didn't include it in the question. For some reason, I didn't copy and paste it in. He also wants Nate to do Leadville and pace him to a win. He said that he didn't want me to do it. He said that I would be too fast. He didn't want Chad to do it because he said Chad's probably going to be busy doing other things, but he wants Nate to pace him in for Leadville.
Let's go with
that. I think Nate should do that. But no, I don't think Nate will actually ever do a mountain bike race again. He's mentioned that he's going to stick to just training and probably just stick to that. He might do some racing in the future. I don't know, some riding, but right now, training, yes. The racing part, he doesn't know if he'll do. So that said, Hannah, what are your thoughts on this one? The downsides of following the carb loading strategy at all times?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to kind of define what carb loading is, because I think that's taken on a lot of different meanings over the course of years. I think a lot of people think of carb loading as consuming a massive amount of food in general that is also carbohydrate.
And like Michael Scott prepping for his marathon.
Exactly. Exactly. That was pretty much the image I had in my mind.
Yeah.
But when I carb load, or when I think of carb loading, what I'm really thinking of is not eating more calories necessarily. It's increasing the percentage of my diet that is carbohydrate. So that's something that I would do, for example, before Leadville. My you know, couple meals before Leadville, like the night before, most of those calories I'm taking in are carbohydrate. That doesn't mean I'm gorging myself with food. So I think that's the first thing to point out there. And as an athlete, depending on how much you're training and at what intensity, more than likely you'll have a higher percentage of your diet be carbohydrate than the average person in general. How much probably depends on how much you're training and how hard. Then the next piece of that is what type of carbohydrates? How are you obtaining those carbohydrates? Very different pancakes and maple syrup than, say, sweet potatoes. They're or mm-hmm. brown rice. Even brown rice versus white rice are very different. And I think that's a good conversation for all of us to have together, because the timing of those is really critical. You know, eating pancakes before a race is fantastic because it's easily digestible. It's going to go into your system quickly. But eating that before you go to bed, probably not optimal. That's going to be not super healthy for you even. So that's where I think this question is really leading, is into the type of carbohydrates that we're consuming.
Yeah, great points. Chad, your thoughts?
I don't have too much to add. Hannah covered that really well. Pretty much everything I was going to say, so I can only reiterate on a couple points. First of which is that, as Hannah said, the term carb loading is misused and misunderstood. Sufficient carbohydrate fueling the work is not carb loading. It's providing enough fuel to do the job that you have ahead of you. Carb loading in our context and the way Nate used it, this was a days out lead in to his event. He was doing the whole, I want to say 10 to 12. Above, yeah. 10 to 12 grams of carbohydrate per hour per kilo. That's a lot of carbohydrate, but he was trying to fully stock the stores. And these were stores that through training had grown to probably the height of their capacity or near it. So when we talk about what you can typically store in muscle, typically store in the liver, and we're talking just about the muscle here, Nate had probably ramped up his storage depots to a point where he could jam a lot in there, and boy was he. And he had a high carbohydrate diet coming into it. So high carbs coming in, lots of endurance training and carb loading prior to the event, he was loaded to the gills, and his performance bared that out. He rode well. He didn't fall short of fuel, except when I don't remember the exact circumstances, but on that last climb, he just couldn't ingest any more carbohydrate, right?
You and I giving him like a boiling pack of Martin.
Yeah, it's terrible. So that was us not intentionally sabotaging him, but that was on us. He had done everything else right. And his performance showed it. So when you're sitting down for breakfast prior to what's going to be a big ride that day or perhaps a race, and you simply fuel sufficiently, that's not carb loading. That's just adequate carbohydrate intake.
Well said. I feel like, so I have a pretty high carb diet in what I would take in, but I feel like the word carb is just way too broad and not specific enough to represent what you should actually be taking in. If your mode or your focus is performance, right? It's a bit more tailored than that. I eat all the time a lot of whole grains and whole foods and carb rich foods. So like this morning, or yesterday morning for breakfast was, sweet potatoes, Brussels sprouts, some broccoli, sweet peppers, some brown rice. And then in addition to that, I had a bit of sausage in there. Right. And that's like, if you look at that, it's pretty darn lean. There's not a whole lot of fat in that. There's some protein in there for sure. There's sufficient protein for what I would need. And then there's lots of carbohydrate. The thing about that is it's really low. Like Hannah said, it's not really high on calorie count. It's not like I'm running that up all the time. And when I get closer to an event, the main way that that changes is I just take in less fiber. I'm eating carbohydrates that just are less rich in fiber, but still carbohydrates. And I make sure that I don't deprive myself coming into an event. I don't get worried about weight. The last week coming into the race, I make sure that I'm nourished, and that's the focus. So that's kind of how it changes. So in one respect, depending on whatever you're eating like now, compared to what your perspective is on what carb loading is, you may have an opportunity to, yes, introduce more carbohydrates into your diet. That doesn't mean, again, that you're eating you know, hard candies, soda, and a bunch of, you know, donuts, like the carbs that people picture in their mind all the time when they hear the word carb. This means that you're taking in. Oh, sorry, Chad. Go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you. I thought you were done.
That's fine.
This does, I mean, Hannah touched on this too. The quality of the carbohydrate is absolutely a concern. But to directly to Jacob's question, what are the downsides to following a carb-loading strategy at all times? If I'm taking that literally, you don't need to do it at all times. You only need to do it prior to competitions. And if it's a big competition where you need to be very loaded, then, you know, maybe a couple of days leading into that competition. But if you're, back to my point, sufficiently fueling via carbohydrate for the work you're about to do, there's no downside in carb loading all the time. Then it just becomes about the quality of the carbohydrates. And that gets, you get a lot of leeway depending on when you ingest those. Again, as Hannah mentioned, you know, 3 hours out versus 1 hour out versus mid-ride versus post-ride, those are all very different levels of forgiveness in terms of the quality of carbohydrate.
Yeah, yeah, great point. And the I think the a big takeaway that we can all grab from this is that so I don't know if I was eating at 12 grams per kilogram of body weight, and I don't know if I've done that. I've never measured it to that degree.
I think you'd have to be you would have to know because you have to eat so much. I mean, to the point, Nate had pushed himself to utter joylessness. I mean, yes. I don't think I've ever reached that with carbohydrate intake.
That was, I don't have a good way of measuring it, but I bet at Cape Epic, I was somewhere around there. Like there was no joy in eating at that point. It was just a absolute task, and it was a hard task, but it was what needed to happen to get the job done. But going throughout a normal day, I don't know how many grams per kilogram of body weight I'm actually eating, you know, and going throughout the day, I have no clue. But I am always making sure that I feel nourished. And then I just, like I said last week on the podcast, I try to eat a lot of colors and I try to experiment with eating a lot of different foods that I might not eat normally and pushing myself kind of out of the comfort zone in that regard. And if I'm doing those things, then I tend to be pretty good. Coming into an event, I might eat a bit more, but I'm definitely just eating less fiber. So I'm trying to like keep it really solid. Now, I do want to cover the downsides though. If you are following like reckless carbs, and I'm going to say in quotes, carb loading strategy, where like, if you're just eating white pasta and you're doing that at 12 grams per kilogram all the time, and you're not training consistently and you're not doing those things, you don't have that need to be able to take that in, then yes, that's not going to be healthy.
You won't have to ask us. You'll see it. You'll see evidence of it in the mirror. You'll see it when you try to put your clothes on. You'll see it and you'll feel it. You go to your physician, they will be all over informing you of all the mistakes you've made because your blood panel's not going to look good. There will be plenty of signs. You won't have to wonder.
Yeah. But on the other hand, if you're eating lots of fruits and veg and you're making sure that you're eating whole grains and you're doing all of those things and you're fueling the work, you'll notice that your body composition becomes what it needs to be, right? And it fuels the work and it looks the way it needs to look. Like that. And that's the cool part about it is that you'll be able to find whatever stasis is for you and you can find it just through nourishment first. So nourishment to fuel performance. So those are my thoughts on it. Hannah, do you have any others to share?
No, I think totally covered it.
Cool. All right. Let's get into Matt's question. If you're listening to this podcast now and if you're watching on YouTube, give it a thumbs up. That's going to help more people find it. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Share it with your friends and leave a review on Spotify. We're still in the lead. We need to extend our lead so that it's unassailable. So we're the top rated podcast for cycling on iTunes and we're the top rated podcast for cycling on Spotify. So keep it going. We appreciate all of you. It's awesome. Last week, by the way, and I didn't prepare it this week. I should have, I just didn't have time. We did trivia, Chad, which we're going to make this a semi-regular thing, cycling trivia on the podcast, because I built so many of these questions with you in mind, but I just had to try it out when we had the vibe duo of Ivy and Ryan last week. Like we had to do it.
Nice.
But so coming up, Chad, we're going to do trivia, not this episode, but another episode. You would have nailed it on a handful of these questions. So.
Yeah, we'll see.
One of them was podcast specific and we added up all the time that has been spent listened to the podcast. Like if you added up every minute listened by every person to the podcast, it was 4,789 years.
Oh,
that's how much actual listen time. So it's amazing. So we just appreciate all of you. You're amazing. Go to the podcast, rate it, share it with your friends. That's how we grow even more. So we don't sponsor this podcast. I literally turn down sponsorship at least five things every single day where companies want to sponsor this podcast. We turn it down all the time because we want to keep it free. And this is one of our only forms of advertising for Trainer Road. So if you appreciate it, rate it, share it, give Train the Road a shot. Matt, this is the question for you, Hannah, specifically. Chad and I've done it once, but then Chad's been support crew once, so he has good context on this event too. So Matt says, thanks for a great cycling resource show. Been a listener for 5 years now, and I love the podcast. Have a question and a challenge. Oh, this is the challenge for Nate, I think. This is a different one. I think this is the pacing one right here. So says, you all have answered several questions in the past with great info, but I'm struggling to apply some learnings. My target race is Leadville 100, and I've tried 6 times to break 9 hours, but which 6 times doing Leadville is respectable. That's a lot of courage, you know, like just to finish it and think, yep, I'll do it again time after time. So my fastest time has been 9:06, which is not a slow time for those lacking context. That's a strong day. I'm a 195-pound rider, and my FTP gets to 350 to 365 watts most seasons. I've been using a coach for the past 3 years and felt like I gave it the best shot during this time. However, since adaptive training has rolled out, I decided to trust Trainer Road with this season's buildup. I started about a month ago, and I have been loving it so far. My question is, I feel like I have the motor to go sub-9, but I need to dial in nutrition. That's instantly, by the way, when he said that he's tried that many times and the best he's done is 9:06 with an FTP of 350 to 350 to 365. I instantly thought nutrition. That's probably where he has a lot of room for improvement here. I just can't seem to eat enough no matter what I do. Do you have any tips for the bigger guys? I feel I cannot eat just gels or liquid, and solids blew me up last year. And then another question, does altitude affect a larger rider more than a smaller one? So, and here's the challenge. It says, I would love to get Nate back out to Leadville and have him pace me to break 9. No offense, Jonathan, but you're too fast. I'm sure Chad is too busy. How great would that be for proof of concept for adaptive training and Trainer Road? Thank you all for being a great resource and making my car time more entertaining and me a faster cyclist. Matt, I don't have plans to do Leadville this year. Chad, any plans to do Leadville this year?
Never. No.
Never.
Yeah. I'm too busy.
Yeah, I think Nate's out too. I might end up being there. I like that excuse that he gave you there, Chad. That was pretty good there. Too busy. But I might end up being out there at the race this year. So I may end up, you know, maybe a person on power line giving you a push. We'll see. But just the same, let's address the questions one by one. I just can't seem to eat enough no matter what I do. Do you have any tips for the bigger guys? He's like, I feel like I cannot just eat gels or liquid. That's a big red flag to me. And then solids blew me up last year, which to me is like, yes, of course they did. So let's go into this. Hannah, do you want to share your thoughts first on at least the nutrition side here for athletes?
Yeah, I get really passionate anytime the word can't is in race day nutrition, because he says he feels like he can't just eat gels or liquid. I'm curious why he feels like he can't. Is it because it's given him problems, or is it because he thinks he shouldn't? Either way, can't is not a word that I like in nutrition. And then I don't quite know, solids blew him up. I'm curious exactly what that means, and I'm curious what solids he was eating, because not all solids are equal. Like blocks and chews are going to be very different than if you tried to pack like a burrito in your pocket or something like that. It's just, it's very different.
Columbine burrito.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the first thing that's the first thing is just can't is not a word that I like in nutrition. And one of the reasons for this is centered around Leadville specifically, because gut distress is more common at that high of elevation. And so pretty much no matter what, I think just expect it to be uncomfortable. It is for everyone. Nobody is out there like, man, I can't wait to eat this next gel. Like it's uncomfortable. You don't want to do it. It's an intellectual decision, not something that you're following because, oh, I feel hungry, or, oh, I want to eat this. You make a plan, you stick to it, no matter how you feel. I mean, there's times I'm putting gels in my mouth when I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't think I could eat a single more thing. But you know what? Because I've trained it, my body knows what to do with it, even if it doesn't feel excellent to do. So that's the thing I would say about that. You do need more carbohydrates at higher altitude, and hunger is suppressed at altitude. that high of altitude. So all of that to say, it's going to be uncomfortable and you just have to push through that. The other thing I would ask him when they're saying that they don't feel like they can eat gels or liquid and solids is, how are you breaking that up? I know, especially at a race like Leadville, where there's really big climbs and then somewhat scary descents or maybe really populated areas, sometimes you'll get behind on your nutrition. And then you'll think, oh my gosh, I need to catch up. And when you're consuming these large boluses is when you can get really mixed up. Because if you go 45 minutes without eating and then try and catch up, that can create gut distress, which then you need to take a break and then you're behind again. And then you just create this perpetual problem. And so staying really focused on maintaining your schedule of nutrition is critical. And that is actually one way I would say nutrition and pacing are two of the most important things at Leadville. And nutrition is one of the ways that I govern my pacing at Leadville, because I have a plan for my nutrition. And if I hit the moment when I'm supposed to eat and I'm not willing to take my hand off the bar to do it, tough luck. You have to slow down then. If I'm going too fast that I feel like I can't eat, I don't deserve to be going that fast. And so that's one of the ways that I would initially approach this situation.
Yeah, there's only one spot on the entire course, or two on the entire course, that I can think of where you'd be going so hard that you wouldn't be able to eat. And that's the very top of Columbine when it gets narrow and it's single track. Well, it's dual track, but you have riders coming down going the other way, and then power line. Other than that, you should be able to eat at any single moment on that course, and you should never feel like you're pushing so hard that you can't eat, because if you are, then your day's going to end. Also, if you think about it, there's 6 aid stations with some neutral aid within there too. There's the neutral aid at the top of Columbine, and then there's also the neutral aid that they have around Turquoise Lake when you come back. But 6 aid stations. Keegan is the only one to go under 6 hours. And the fastest athletes get very close to 6 hours. So if you're in that pace, then that's great, because you can eat every hour. But even then, you shouldn't be spreading your nutrition out to just taking it a bunch every hour. When Chad was my support crew at Leadville, he was giving me a ton at the aid stations, but I was eating it constantly. There wasn't a single time where I wasn't eating. I was always drinking carbs through my pack. And I was always taking gels. In fact, I remember even coming into every aid station, and I had it timed so that I'd have the last gel coming into the aid station, and rolling up to Chad, I'd be sucking on my pack and choking down like that and finishing off the last gel. And then when I left, I was taking in more. That's just what you do. So it's like, there's this, I wonder that if I can't, I feel like I can't eat gels or liquid. A lot of that comes from people saying, well, I get palate fatigue and I don't want to take it in. I really like how you phrased it, Hannah. It's an intellectual decision driven by a plan. It's not a pleasure-driven decision driven by natural impulse like hunger, right? And taste and preference. And I know that sounds really soulless, but keep in mind what you're doing. Like, you're asking your body to do something that is really difficult, that requires a lot of fuel. This is very different than when you sit down to an amazing dinner that you're really excited to eat. That, like, you don't have to try to replicate that experience of a delicious something when you're riding your bike and at like the sort of intensity where it's your only goal for the season. It's a big race. Those circumstances matter to you. So in those situations, you can't let something like palate fatigue take priority over the many hours of training and dedication and all the resources you put into your race. That's how you can really put yourself into a bad spot. Chad, what are your thoughts? I mean, he is a bigger rider, and you also have had a high FTP. And so, like, you know, you've mentioned that you'd never ate enough before in your career, and you've only kind of discovered later on. But as a big rider with a big FTP, even though it's up at high elevation, there's going to be a lot of burn going on, right?
Absolutely. And just to dovetail off of what Hannah said, what you reiterated, it's absolutely, it's not built to be a pleasurable process. This isn't an eating tour. It's a bike race. So it's not going to be great the whole time. You're not going to have the option to say, oh, I'm not hungry right now, I'm not going to eat. And trust me when I say that no one has a happy gut 4, 5, 6 hours into bombing it with carbohydrate. Nobody. Yeah. You just have to – I mean, that's the basis behind gut training. That's why it's necessary to prepare yourself for that, to train your gut to be able to perform at the same level that your legs are going to perform, that your lungs are going to perform, that your circulatory system is going to perform. Got to train it. And I did want to touch on the fact that the only difference I can see for a larger rider over a smaller one when it comes to altitude is basically what Hannah said, but I want to elaborate on it. She said it requires more carbohydrate. And think about why that may be. If you're at higher altitude, the air's less dense, there's less oxygen, there's less aerobic respiration. That means you have to lean more heavily on your glycolytic resources. This is going to increase your reliance on carbohydrate. That's it. It's less air. You're going to have to eat more to do the same amount of work because you can't work as aerobically as you do when you're down at, you know, closer to sea level.
Mm-hmm. I can't help but think too, you know, if you like your power that you're going to be producing, I think that I did 200 and what was it? I don't know if you remember, Chad, it was like 220 watts or something all day at Leadville. Mm-hmm. I think that was like my average power for the day. It was 220 for 8 hours and 17 minutes.
Oh, you know what? Having said this, I don't want to derail you, but that does actually weigh into this. You are doing less work. So you do need a little less carbohydrate because of that. So if you have a threshold of 350 and you're going to take a 10% hit, so now your threshold is effectively, you know, 320, 317, whatever. That does mean a little less, but I mean, when would you possibly ever err but on the side of excess when it comes to carbohydrate intake over a heart event that lasts 6 to, you know, how many hours?
Yeah, as long as you've trained it beforehand, right? Like don't just be like on race day, I'm going to take in 100 grams of carbs an hour, having previously only done 30 grams per hour. That's going to land you in a tour de porta potty for the race instead of an actual good race. So like,
absolutely. And what you were talking about with me in particular, but just insufficient carbohydrate intake and how everyone is now opening their eyes to the fact that, wow, having more carbohydrates actually makes me feel better, race better, perform better, recover better, et cetera. It does. I read a lot of cycling autobiographies, and right now I'm reading Nicholas Roach's, and it's the same thing. And you read his race journals and you hear him talk about having a flat day, all these unfavorable occurrences that take place, every one of them. I mean, maybe not every one of them. There are some that are crash related and strategy related and just mishap related, but most of them, you can trace it all back to insufficient fueling. And when they talk about how if it's someone's birthday, we get cake on that day. And I'm thinking, you guys should be eating cake every day and in whatever amounts it seems correct, just eat it. You'll sure. Use it. I promise.
In the middle of a grand tour, right?
Like, it was so backwards. And I mean, at some point the light bulb had to come on for each of these athletes where they recognized, oh my God, I left so much performance on the table simply because I was worried about my body weight or my director sportif wouldn't allow us to have enough food or. And there are just so many ways they impose these self-limitations on themselves. It was, it's always interesting to read. I mean, hindsight being what it is.
Yeah. And we tend to emulate that, like too much us athletes or us average folks. Like we think that, you know, eating is cheating and we fall into that narrative and we beat this drum constantly on the podcast that that's not the perspective to achieve good performance and health. I think Hannah, you shared a quote the other day. And it was from a person that had set like they had held the mile record for a long time and they ran something like a, what was it? Like a 4:50 or 4:15 or something mile. And I don't know if you have the specifics.
Yeah. It was something that Steve Magnus shared, on Twitter. And I don't remember the specifics exactly, but what it was is looking at someone's training journal, and he ran a 4:07 and wrote in his journal, felt very difficult. And then the very next day, he ran a mile in 3:51. So significantly faster. And he wrote, felt very easy.
Yeah. And I couldn't help but think when I saw that, I was like, I bet he ate more carbs. Like, it's like, because it was funny because it was being shared in a lot of different contexts. I saw a ton of athletes and coaches and different like team staff personnel and stuff sharing that and being like, look, like, you know, your days vary and the circumstances vary. And sometimes sometimes you just give your best and sometimes it's more or less. And in my mind, I was looking at that and I'm like, yes, well, that's true, but I bet he had more carbs. Like, like, you know, I bet it was the difference.
Hannah, was that Roger Bannister? I was trying to pinpoint how long ago that.
I don't think it was Bannister. I don't think that was the name. No.
Was it a recent?
No,
it wasn't
from quite some time ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Quite some time. But that's it's a very important point. The solids blew me up last year. The reason that solids tend to blow up athletes is when you're dealing with like racing in these sort of conditions, most athletes push too hard at Leadville. Like Hannah said, you shouldn't be pushing too hard. And then it's up at high elevation. You don't process food quite as well because everything is just taxed higher. And like Chad said, you're almost in like inherently more glycolytic, and then you deprive your body of that. And as a result, everything gets messed up. So easy to get dehydrated up there too. Like you have to drink so much fluid. And if you don't have all those pieces in place, then you're putting something solid into your stomach and you're like, please stomach, digest like you would under normal circumstances. And your stomach's like, I'm not up to that task, you know? And this has got me wondering,
he's talking about solids blowing him up. Was this the same year?
Yes.
I lost my place in the question. Yes. Okay. So if he had solids in his stomach, they're probably not going anywhere. If he's doing a fair amount of work, they're probably not getting digested at the rate he needs them to digest. And then he's pouring gels and blocks and all the things he thinks he now can't eat. Mm-hmm. Could absolutely relate to that. If he's got a gut that's effectively stalled and he's trying to pour more nutrition on top of it, that nutrition's not going anywhere. If it is, mm-hmm. it's going very slowly. This could absolutely be part of the problem. So if maybe that same eating approach minus the solids early on, I bet this rider would be surprised at how much gels and other form of carbohydrate he could ingest over the course of the rest of the race without feeling the need to stop.
Yeah. I can't help, but I want to talk, I'm going to opine here and guess and hypothesize. This is not scientific at all. But this question of does altitude affect a larger rider more than a smaller one? Hannah and I were talking about this in preparation for this podcast, Chad. Christian Blumenfeld just this weekend won 70.3 world championships. We've talked about Christian Blumenfeld and how he is visually like a pariah because he doesn't look like what we've come to expect a world-class Ironman athlete to be, like a world champion, much less one that has set the fastest Ironman time only a month or two after winning the Olympics. And at the same time went sub-7 for full with that sub-7 project. And then placed third at Kona this year. And then also ends up getting the 70.3 world title. Like he's an incredible athlete. Like one of the greatest triathletes ever. He's had a whole entire career of achievements in the space of 12 months. Like it's just astounding. He doesn't look like the normal triathlete. He isn't long, lean, and like a Mr. Incredible shape where they're just like an upside down triangle, right? Instead, he's built strong. He's like a Lego man, right? and when he's out there on the course, he is able to perform. And when he's training, he is able to perform above the level of everybody else. And I've heard his coach and Christian kind of like joke around almost about this, but like reference it kind of in passing about like his huge lung capacity, because he has such a broad chest, barrel chest. And if you look, like his chest even almost like pushes out to the front, like more than you would expect from a normal person. And he's joked about his gigantic lungs that he has. And when you think about how like oxygen uptake works, right, Chad? So when you're talking about oxygen end up getting to the muscles, and then that allows the work to happen. But then you follow the chain all the way back out to oxygen and the pressure in the air. You know, if you have a bottleneck along all the different many steps that need to happen to get oxygen to your blood in one way or another, or to your muscles in one way or another, it's going to end up affecting your ability to perform. And if you are a bigger athlete,
aerobically.
Yes. Yeah. Good point. If you're a bigger athlete and you have a gigantic set of lungs. I don't know. Nate played tuba, was it, for years? I don't know if he has a gigantic set of lungs on him too, but that could very well just make the mouth of the funnel wider. It doesn't mean anything in terms of what happens after that, right? Because you could just be constrained to like a typical human thereafter. But it does make me wonder if a larger athlete, you know, they're muscular, they have more musculature most likely, so they have greater demand. So maybe you're just, it balances itself out. But if you did have extra large lungs, Chad,
yeah,
what do you think?
The limitation is pretty much always, not always, maybe always, I don't know, limited at the muscle. So it's a peripheral limitation. So it's as getting oxygen to the muscle typically isn't the bottleneck. It's what the muscle can do once it gets the oxygen. And in the case of Blumenfeld, I think he's got three things going for him, three very evident things going for him. He's got a massive aerobic engine. He's got a tremendous ability to metabolize carbohydrate, and he fuels really well. I think he could honestly probably reduce it to those three things. And he's obviously efficient. He's obviously very fit. I mean, he's got a lot of other things beyond that, but I think those three things are probably the biggest deciders.
I think he, and we all like to say this about ourselves, but I do think that he has an absolutely unique ability to push himself. Like, I don't think he's doing the
cross-country. Yeah, it's hard to discount that.
Yeah, like the cross-country skier starfish. I don't think he's doing that after the races for dramatic purposes. He just doesn't. When you hear his interviews, he's not a dramatic guy. He's very dry, cutting,
anyone, you know, very focused. Anyone who excels on the world stage, that's part and parcel. Yeah, you have to be extremely tough psychologically, almost to the point where it doesn't really bear mentioning. It's just, it's an assumption that you have to make. You can't compete at that very pointy end of things and succeed, win at that end of things, unless you're just locked down psychologically.
I think if more races than not over the past 12 years, he has finished and gone like he needed medical attention. Like, and I'm not trying to glorify, like, you know, pushing yourself beyond that.
Yeah.
But I find that as evidence. And also when you talk to his coach and then Gustav Iden that trains with him as well, who is the Ironman world champion, that's like a commonly referenced thing where like Christian's ability to push himself in training and everything else, like he pushes really, really hard, like harder than most. He also mentions that when he goes to altitude, he just doesn't feel it. He doesn't feel any negative effect. Like it's fine. Like there's no issue for him. And he like wants to just do more and more and keep going. And he's an absolute, right. Maybe altitude isn't real. Yeah, maybe. Super interesting one. But yeah, I think going back to the root of it though, Hannah, what do you think?
Yeah, I thought about this a lot after our conversation, like the different, you know, lung size and all of those things. And I kept going through it in my mind. And eventually I feel like what I landed on was, okay, so what does that mean? What can I change about my lungs? Like if that's not the physical gift that I was given, what is it benefiting me to think about what this other person has or what I don't have? And it brought me back to Matt's question of if he's a 195-pound rider and that's his weight, that's his healthy weight that he's going to be at, don't worry about it. Even if altitude is harder for larger riders, you're not going to suddenly become a smaller rider. So why compare your experience to another person's experience when you can't change it? So instead of focusing on that question, I would focus on the things that you can change. So it's not about ignoring that obstacle necessarily. It's just about focusing on how you can change it. So the nutrition question associated with it is great because nutrition is something you can control. But being a larger rider and altitude potentially affecting you more because of it is not something that you can control. And why even bother comparing your experience to others, especially if you're worried about time? And if the question is, well, gosh, I'm a big rider and I just don't know if at my size I can break 9 hours. Well, guess what, Matt? You already did 9:06. So I would say you can definitely break 9 hours. I would bet on you that you can find 6 minutes in the Leadville race. So I just wouldn't worry about that aspect. And I would put the energy into the nutrition side of this question.
Awesome advice, Hannah. I love it. That's like the pro focus too, right, Chad? Where like pros aren't going to bother with worrying about things that they can't change like that. Instead, they worry about what they can. So, okay, Cass's question. Hey there, I really love listening to your podcast. It inspires me to become a better cyclist. I have a question about struggling to rest. I ride about 7 to 8 hours a week over 3 to 4 sessions and do 2 strength sessions a week. However, I still feel like I need to do at least 10,000 steps a day. And that 10,000 steps a day is like a common general health recommendation that we see provided. And with the rise of step trackers, whether that's through your watch or some sort of fitness tracker in one way or another, it's been a good way for folks or for researchers and scientists and medical professionals to give all of us like an actionable goal to reach like a level of activity that can keep us healthy. And when I say us, I'm talking about us as humans. I'm not talking about us as athletes. It's generally reserved for a recommendation for folks that are typically sedentary or non-athlete folks. So, Cass says, I know this is probably impacting my recovery from sessions and was wondering if you had any information on how walking or doing more steps affects cycling performance and recovery. Cheers from Cass. So I looked into research to try to find some sort of any type of research that looks at athletes taking 10,000 steps a day and how it could affect recovery adversely, everything else. And I didn't find anything. The research instead that I found was just an overwhelming amount of research showing the positive health benefits for sedentary individuals and those recovering from severe illness or anything else like that. And that getting them to the point where they can take 10,000 steps a day is very beneficial for folks in those situations. But it's kind of different for athletes, right, Hannah? Like, you know, adding on 10,000 steps a day may not be the thing that you need to get faster.
Yeah, I think so. For me, I have this abstract idea of energy as a limited resource. None of us have unlimited energy. So if you think of it like a battery, I view, you know, training, for example, drains that battery. You're spending energy. And then when you recover, you're building the energy back up. And so in a perfect, completely controlled world, if you were a professional athlete or training was your only goal, that's what you would do. You would train and drain the battery, and then you would recover and build it back up. But
isn't that what pro athletes' lives are like, Hannah?
That's exactly what I was going to say. But even if you're a professional athlete, you're still a human being. And then even more so, if you're not a professional athlete, you have even more things on top of that. And so that's where I think this model still works, but can become a little bit more nuanced. So for example, spending time grilling out with family, that in theory might drain a little bit of the battery. But the joy associated with that and the positive impacts of your life might actually add to your energy level. It adds motivation and subjective things like that. So it drains a little bit, but maybe you gain even more. And so I think it's a constant balance of deciding whether you're draining more or gaining more from those extra things. And so 10,000 steps a day, if for some reason that is giving you a lot of joy, maybe you're gaining those by walking your dog or something like that, that just gives you a tremendous amount of joy, it might be benefiting you enough that it's counteracting whatever drain it is. But if it's not providing you with that joy in some way, you're probably just draining yourself unnecessarily. And I would add to that as well that what serves you at one point might not serve you at another. So if at one point 10,000 steps brought you great joy, but now it's just become a thing that you have to do because as athletes, sometimes we can become really focused and have to driven. It might be draining you now and it didn't before. And so that's where we constantly have to check in with ourselves and keep that balance alive.
Well said. Chad, your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a good concluding point there, Hannah. Has this veered into the territory of compulsion? I mean, are you doing these 10,000 steps regardless of how fatigued you are? And maybe even more straightforward is the glaring omission here is how is your training progressing? You haven't said, you think it's probably impacting my recovery, but you haven't informed us as to whether or not you're on an upward swing. Are you improving? Is your recovery even hampered? Because if everything's on that upward desired trajectory, if you're performing well in your workouts, performing well in your competitions, should you compete, if things are just going generally positively, then this is absolutely not an issue. When it starts to become a concern is if those 10,000 steps are coming at the expense of something else. And most noticeably, that would be your recovery. So if on the harder days or the ends of the week or the ends of a training cycle, when you are just tired, but you're still making yourself do those 10,000 steps, ask yourself, what am I gaining from this? Is this hindering my performance? And you'll know soon enough. I mean, it's a sad fact that there's going to be a little bit of a lag there, and you may not know exactly lockstep with your training. Today was the day for me to not do those 10,000 steps. Sadly, you'll probably find out several days or even a week or two past it. I need to start dialing back to 5,000 or maybe just have a day where I don't measure my steps. But again, if it's negatively impacting your training, your progress in any manner, then those 10,000 steps become a concern.
I think this morning I'm following the half distance Ironman low volume plan, Chad. It's exciting stuff right now. So I just started that this week. This morning on a run, it was 5 miles is what I ended up running, just like 5.2 miles, I think. And in those 5.2 miles, my watch gave me 7,500 steps. So I don't know if it was accurately tracking that, but that's kind of like a good, a good bit of context for you all, because 10,000 steps doesn't mean anything to me when I think of that in terms of what it would be. But imagine, forgive me, imagine walking that many miles, right? 5 miles. If you were to, and then I, the way that I always try to think of it to more push me toward the side of erring on being conservative is imagine when you finish your last interval and then saying, all right, how would you feel about doing 10,000 steps now? And your body, you'd probably be like, please no, I just want to relax. But we get far enough away from that discomfort that we kind of forget about that. And then we think, yeah, this isn't hurting me. This isn't affecting me. It's just like we've used that same pattern of thought with dropper posts where it's like finish with a sprint finish and then tell me that like, okay, now instantly cross the line. And before you can even catch a breath, just ghost ride your bike and then stand up and then do 45 air squats. And you would be like, no, I would cramp and fall over, you know, like, and I know that that's not entirely fair because you're talking about, you know, when you're really exhausted right in the moment, of course, it's a bit more intense, but if it isn't making you faster, there's a broad spectrum here. And the most intense that you can get with it, the most, I guess, measured and diligent and everything else is if it isn't making me faster, then I'm not going to do it. And, but to Hannah's point, that isn't just the hard work part of training. There are many other things that give you, that refill your tank, that fill your cup and can help you out in that regard. But keep in mind,
Jonathan,
10,000 steps is not insignificant.
You touched on a pretty reliable tell there is that there are emotional reaction to just the idea of something can be very telling. I mean, there are days where you just don't feel up to the task and emotionally you have to push yourself a little bit. You have to give yourself that kick in the butt and do it. And you find out, no, I'm good. I just needed to get rolling. But it can go the other way. There can be those situations where just the idea of doing anything, these 10,000 steps, a strength session, another session on the bike, a recovery ride, your chores, you know, take out the garbage. If those have an emotional impact on you and make you feel a little sick or just outwardly demotivated, pay attention to that. It can be very reliable, especially over time, especially when you allow yourself to recognize, last time this happened, did my workout and everything, you know, the wheels came off the wagon over the next few days. I should have recognized this was the tipping point. Now I do recognize that I'm going to give myself that day off. And then maybe you find out, I didn't really need that day off. So what? You make these trials and errors. You eventually get it more right than wrong. But your emotional reaction to anything you have to do, specifically a workout, can be very telling, very reliable.
Yeah. I really liked your idea, Chad, too, of simply not measuring it anymore. I think that could be very helpful in this process because then if you still feel like you need or want to go for a walk, it hopefully is just emotionally making you feel happy and it's not trying to hit this specific number.
Yeah. Great way to manage it. I like it. Before we go into the next question, I want to mention that we're hiring for support staff here. It's an awesome team. We have athletes and folks from all around the world that work with us, and they're amazing. So we have quite a few pro athletes that that work for this. So if you're a pro athlete listening to this, you may be interested. It's a good way because you can work with your legs up in recovery boots and you can still be working, which is pretty awesome. But if you're not an athlete and you would be interested in working for Trainer Road, go to trainerroad.com/jobs and you can check it out. We'd love to have you join us. And also I want to mention, I mentioned trivia earlier. If this is something that you're a listener and you listen to trivia and you enjoyed it, let me know. So then we can continue to do it. We're going to do it next time Chad's on. And Chad, trivia, I feel like goes hand in hand with a nice beverage of whatever choice you have. So you're welcome to, you know, bring whatever you have. I'll have a Topo Chico
or something. If I must.
Yeah. There we go. So it'll be a good one. In fact, I'm going to send you the trivia questions that I did last week just because I feel cool. You'll enjoy them. So
yeah, let's see. It can be it's a fickle thing. So I feel like I should be really good at trivia. And then I find myself in a situation where I I get to play trivia and whatever type, maybe not bike specific, and not particularly good at trivia, but we'll see.
I bet you'll beat Nate at the cycling specific trivia when it's asking questions about racing. And in the past, I bet you'll beat him. So, that way that'll not fire Nate up and then he'll actually want to beat you at something.
I got to say too, to backtrack a little bit with our support agents, there are some dangerously fast support agents to the point where I've grown basically just discouraged. I mean, I used to think in my prime I was fast, and then I see all these guys, these athletes, these guys and girls, and it's humbling.
It's pretty amazing. We're super inspired by you all. It's really cool. So, Paul says, and once again, there is no like watt kg limit to join the support staff. We just have a lot of really fast athletes that have liked to do it, but we also have a lot of folks that don't even ride bikes all the time. And instead they are just fantastic support agents that are drawn to it for different reasons and they love it. We would love to have you working for us. So go apply. Paul says, I really like the podcast. Thank you all for sharing information that can benefit people who may not even be racing events, but simply love the challenge like myself. I can be extremely competitive, but I'm certainly not a racer. I really enjoy gravel endurance racing, and I used to be a roadie, but now I seek the quiet country and mountain gravel paths. My next event is unpaved, going for the 125-mile option, and the goal is simply to finish and not die in the process. Like I said, not a racer. Paul then says, my question is about nutrition on the bike. Does the order of certain nutrition interrupt what the next calorie type will be? For example, I make oat and peanut butter bites with some other ingredients that have around 19 grams of carbs and 4 grams of protein and around 150 calories per bite, and probably a good helping of fat there too, if it's peanut butter in there. So I have one of these, then follow it with an SIS gel 20 to 30 minutes later. Will the protein of the peanut butter, and I would add fat as well, of the peanut butter slow the absorption rate of the gel since it is already in the process of being digested, hence making the gel less effective when I need a quick energy hit? I really want to make sure that I'm getting the maximum benefit of the calories that I'm taking in, especially on a 5, 6, 7, or even a 10-hour ride. Thanks so much for all the knowledge. Chad, does the order of what we take in affect things?
Yeah, and Paul, full disclosure, this was a question that made the docket quite a while back, and I jotted down some studies and I had to quickly refresh my memory. I'm not going to dive into any of them, just to say that 2016, 17, and 19, three different studies all basically confirm the same thing. And they show what I think a lot of people common sensibly put together is that food sequence, or what they term meal pattern, does absolutely matter. That in the case of all three of these studies, the carbohydrate last meals, so the carbohydrate on the heels of fat and protein versus the pre-carbohydrate meals or carbohydrate preceding those things, absolutely impacted postprandial hyperglycemia. So basically the changes in your blood sugar that happen after you've finished eating. So you have that carbohydrate first, you're going to get a bigger spike in insulin, glucose in the bloodstream, et cetera. You basically preload your stomach with things that effectively gum up the works and slow that release, that digestion, and therefore that release of glucose into the bloodstream, then you're not going to see that same high impact. So it does matter if you're out on the road. And well, actually, the very next question we're going to cover, I'll hopefully get to elaborate on this a bit more. But if you need a quick hit of energy, don't put anything as a roadblock. Don't put anything in its way. It's straightforward in that sense. You think it would work that way, and it does work that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Hannah, what thoughts do you have on this one?
Yeah, I think for this one, I'd really just share kind of a personal anecdote of the feeling that I have when I don't follow the proper order, because I think that's the biggest thing you can listen to, is your body is probably actually telling you what's happening if you listen to it. Because if I ate something like this peanut butter bite that this person is describing, then I would feel full. I would probably not want to eat something else. So I either wouldn't, or I would start to feel uncomfortable by consuming it. And so I think it's showing that you're filling yourself up rather than consuming energy that you're then using. And I think that shows what's happening, but also why create any other difficulties in fueling? Fueling is hard enough and potentially uncomfortable enough. I don't want to be eating something that then makes me so full that I really don't want to eat anything else as well. Because 19 grams of carbs and 150 calories in terms of RAD food, it's not a great ratio. You would need to consume so much to hit your carbohydrate intake that if you want to maximize the benefits of your calories, it's just not happening.
For real, Paul, right? You can think of it in the context that, or just from the viewpoint that satiety is not your friend in a situation like this. It can work well for you if you're on a weight loss plan or a body composition modification plan. But when it comes to a situation where you need to be eating all the time, anything you do that weighs the scale in favor of you remaining hungry or as close to hunger as you can get is favorable. So putting something in your gut that's going to take a long time to process that will inspire a feeling of satiety, make you feel satiated, full, no longer interested in eating is not a good idea.
This is absolutely influenced from like with my son watching shows and playing with like trains and trucks and everything else. So bear with me, parents, this might be really relatable for you. But I've always envisioned this, like if you break down the three macros of protein, fat, and carbohydrate, if you envision it like a highway that's necking down into a tiny little queuing system, and for every vehicle that passes through, you end up having to like dismantle the guard to be able to let them through, and you have to do it in a one by one manner. Carbs are like motorcycles. They can fit right through, zero issue. When you're dealing with protein and fat, they're like big old trucks, and it takes a long time and it slows things up. And if you have enough big old trucks right up against the gate, the motorcycles can't even get through, so they're going to be stuck. And hopefully that helps somebody with some sort of visualization. But the fact is that this is kind of going back to what we were talking about in Leadville. I bet, Paul, those things are delicious that you made. And I bet you've also on these longer rides probably adopted this perspective that like, well, I don't need to just eat gels. And it's absolutely true that you don't need to. But if your goal is to optimize performance and looking back at your goal, you say that your goal is simply to finish and not die in the process. Like I said, not a racer. But then up above, you say I can be extremely competitive. So Paul, I know that even though when this gun goes off in this race, even though you say that you are not going in with this goal to, you know, set the world on fire, you're going to go faster than you think and you're going to enjoy that. And when a person's like right next to you or when you see a person down the road, you're going to want to catch that person. So like this isn't us being exclusive in this sense and saying like racers should only take in carbs. Anybody should, like, because you owe it to yourself to have a happier gut or maybe a less dissatisfied gut, right? And you owe it to yourself to be able to show all the fitness that you've worked hard for. It'd be a shame if you showed up and had a nutrition plan that nerfs you on race day. Like it should enable you. It should take all that you have and activate it rather than keep some of it dormant. So,
well, and if you do eat these and then in turn you're so full that you can't eat carbs or other things, then you're inviting a bonk, and a bonk can feel like you're dying. So that wouldn't even achieve your goal of finishing without feeling like you're dying.
Yeah. Best way to ruin a ride is that right there. So yeah.
And on race day, everything's forgivable. Just stop worrying about these things, because even if you completely overfuel to the point where you take on hundreds of extra grams of carbohydrate and therefore calories, coming out the other side of that, you're not going to see any lasting impact for that. If you're on a specific eating pattern or diet modification and you go off it for race day, you'll get back on it in the days ahead and you'll never even feel it. At worst, it'll be this little speed bump with small fluctuation in your body composition for half a day. Just nothing that merits any real concern.
Absolutely. These have been good questions. If you have a question for the podcast, you can submit it at trainerroad.com/podcast. We're going to get into Pat's question. It's the last one here. Pat says, thoughts on using, quote, mass gainers during endurance, like 100-mile mountain bike races. I've used them successfully to get in a ton of calories per bottle, but I'm somewhat concerned about the protein percentage, though. I Googled mass gainers because I wanted to find the amazing product names because they always exist. It's like,
they're super
like
good.
Wolfman Hydroflex or like some like crazy thing that they always have, you know? There are some great names. So if you want to have a fun Google for a while, go ahead and do that. Mass gainers, Chad, they're typically like bodybuilders take these things in, right?
Bodybuilders and hard gainers. And for that reason, I I will probably call them hard gainers for whatever reason that nomenclature sticks with me. But, you know, people who are struggle to add muscle mass to their frames and people who are simply trying to add muscle mass, no struggle. They just want more calories for more muscle. That's what we're talking about here. But more specifically, the topic is co-ingestion. So we're talking about combining macronutrients at ingestion. And ingestion is a tricky one. I really wish researchers, people in general, would be more specific and they would talk about ingestion versus absorption versus oxidation, if we could have those three terms. Ingestion and absorption typically get coupled into the same term, and it takes me a little while to determine what they're talking about. For our purposes, they're going to be the same thing. If it goes in your mouth, we're assuming it makes it into your bloodstream via the small intestine, okay? Mm-hmm. Ingestion and absorption, same thing for the purpose of this discussion and for most scientific papers, really. So anyway, back on track. The issue here is probably mostly protein co-ingestion with the carbohydrate, because the fat, there is some fat in there, but these hard gainers, they lean heavily on the protein, not so much on the fat, and they lean even more heavily on the carbohydrate. But protein co-ingestion, or really even just protein ingestion during recovery, pretty widely accepted that it's beneficial, right? Largely because it enhances glycogen resynthesis, restocks our muscles with the necessary sugar. If we have a second workout on the same day, the timing all enters into it, et cetera, et cetera. And it impacts favorably, assuming your protein intake is sufficient, muscle protein synthesis. So during recovery, check. Agreement, consensus. Uh-huh. Also during competition, and this does come with caveats. So there has been research that's demonstrated improvements in time to exhaustion and time trial performance, but it looks like the co-ingestion of protein with carbohydrate came largely due to insufficient intake of carbohydrate. So basically they were underfueling. They added protein, served as a little more fuel because yes, carbohydrate or protein can metabolize as glucose eventually. They just got more calories. So again, this is more proper fueling for the work. As cliche as that term's come, it's a simple one and it stands up. And when they do this, I'll just get this out of the way now, they typically ingest, whether it's on the bike, this is on the bike, at a particular ratio. So whether it's 4:1, 3:1, or 2:1, those are the most common ratios. That means if you're ingesting, for instance, 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour, I think most people know that that's kind of a bare minimum for multi-hour moderate intensity endurance endeavors, then that would translate to co-ingesting anywhere from 15 to 30 grams of protein per hour. So in the case of someone who's doing a heck of a lot of work, then 60 grams is probably insufficient. So adding another 15 to 30 grams of protein, which isn't going to go straight across to carbohydrate, but you'll get a fair amount of carbohydrate yield from those, proves to be a beneficial thing. So the what I'm getting at here is the notion of fueling or co-ingesting protein on the bike with your carbohydrate isn't about preserving muscle mass. It isn't about you may want it to be about that, but any of the benefits that have been measured or cited in the research or mentioned in the research is simply because it translates to more caloric intake.
So I can't help but wonder then in that case, why would you be even mixing protein into the mix because of its abilities to, to disrupt digestion and everything else, and you could just add more carbohydrate. Is that a fair question in this case, Chad?
That's really my question, and I can't answer it. I couldn't answer it with the research I did, and I really want to know. I would like to know if this has been researched or if it is being researched, because it's a very interesting topic, because we're very clear and we're getting more clear on how much we can transport when it's simply glucose, how much we can add to that when it's glucose fructose, how much we can add to that when it's galactose, when all these little modifications we make. Well, if we've topped out what our bodies can process on the carbohydrate side, could we by chance increase that further by adding a little bit of protein?
It's an interesting, but I can't help but think that it would probably fly in the face of taking more carbohydrate because it would slow digestion, right, of the carbohydrate that you have.
Maybe the work hasn't been done. So could this be yet an alternate or actually a supplemental fuel substrate? Could we add protein to it and take that, 110 maximum? Actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me back up and cool. See if I can answer that question better with some of the things I did find. So I see the concerns here being in the context of carbohydrate. What's the profile? Is there a mix of sugars? Are we optimizing absorption into the bloodstream and therefore into the muscles? When it comes to the protein, Can we look at it as an oxidizable fuel? Can this elevate fuel oxidation above the carbohydrate optimum or maximum that currently seems to reside at about 1.75 grams, which translates to about 105 grams per hour. Now, this is oxidation. You can ingest more, you can absorb more, but what the muscles can actually use seems to be about 105 grams per hour, and that's ingested carbohydrate, because when you add what's coming from glycogen's internal, you know, internal glucose stores, that number creeps up to a bit higher. I think it's actually 2.5 to 3.5.
Yeah, so it jumps Jorgensen up quite a bit. Said he was taking in 160 on the podcast.
Yeah, but that's, again, that's what he's ingesting, and that's what can make it into the bloodstream, but that's not necessarily what the muscle can oxidize.
Yeah, exactly.
From ingested carbohydrate, again, if it's on board, it can supplement what you ingest. It will supplement what you ingest because glycogen is continually utilized. Yeah. And then the third concern is when it comes to fat. You know, what are the effects on the carbohydrate absorption and the gastric emptying rate? These are two very big concerns when we're talking about adding fat to our race fuel or training fuel. So each of these questions actually leads to its own consideration. I got to make a quick detour prior to those considerations and talk about hard gainer composition really quickly. So if you've seen these big old canisters of powder, they are always, almost always interestingly named and interestingly flavored. I saw an apple fritter one that just sounds good. It just makes me want to eat it.
I think I saw a s'mores one.
Yeah. Oh, they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
That's good marketing. Yeah. Okay. So first off, let's be clear. We're mixing this with water. There is an option to mix it with milk. Not only would that mess with our macronutrient profile and absorption and digestion and all the things, but I'm pretty sure nobody wants milk in their water bottle. So I looked at several of these, but I'm just going to frame it with two ends of the spectrum. First, the hard gainer one versus hard gainer two. The low end of the spectrum, it was about 162 grams, which translates to about 1.5 cups mixed with 12 ounces of water, which is about 350 milliliters of water. Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. Carbohydrate content was 110 grams, seems to be pretty good, and protein content was 32 grams. That's about a 3.4 to 1 ratio. So that's really close to that 4 to 1 ratio, 3 to 1 ratio. Seems pretty good. Yeah. And the fat was 9 grams. So not a ton of fat, at least not relative to all the protein and carbohydrate. Totals out to about 650 calories. So with respect to the carbohydrate, that's sludge. I mean, that's some thick stuff going down. And that does create concerns about gut osmolality and things stopping up and pulling water out of the, you know, the cooling system and out of the blood into the gut, not favorable. And then good carbohydrate, we don't know what the mix is. We'll actually get to that in a bit. Protein's fair, but if carbohydrate absorption is already maxed out, does that protein do anything? That's still the question. And then the other end of the spectrum, this, I would just see this broken into two servings. It'd have to be because it's 333 grams with 2.5 cups of water, which is about 24 ounces of water, 700 mils. So, you know, big bottle. Putting 2.5 cups of powder in a big bottle is going to, again, yield sludge, pure sludge. I don't know. I don't even know how they consume it. Carbohydrate here is 245 grams. Split it in half, 120 grams per hour. Seems reasonable. Protein's 52 grams. That translates to about a 4.7 to 1 ratio. So on the higher side of things, but they're not really going crazy with the protein relative to the carbohydrate, especially relative or compared to the studies that have done 4 to 1 mixes. And then fat's just 10 grams, so basically the same. And this is double the calories, 1,280 calories. So split it across two bottles, maybe double the water. Maybe this actually could work out. So now let's get to those considerations. First, the form of carbohydrate in the hard gainers, it's almost always maltodextrin, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So that means at 120 grams of carbohydrate in the first one, that's twice what we know we can absorb via the glucose transporters when it's simply, well, glucose. The second one had a little bit of glucose, but it was listed in that column of less than 2%. So no significant amount of glucose, really. It's still maltodextrin. And this one was, you know, twice the amount. So that means four times those 60 grams. Obviously, cool. That's not going anywhere. So if you're slamming that into the system, even if you're taking it in slowly over, or evenly over the course of an hour, it's going to sit in the gut. It's going to be there for quite some time. So on the carbohydrate side, I'm going to have to say hard no to hard gainers. Second consideration is the protein absorption rates. And this is a concern because there are a lot of different proteins in these hard gainers. I mean, if you compare whey versus something like egg whites, and no one's going to put cooked egg in there, but all these different proteins absorb at very different rates. So if it's a faster,
wild, I don't know.
If it's a faster absorption rate, this leads to a more oxidizable substrate. This does mean, you know, if it, in the case of whey protein, if it burns really quickly, processes really quickly, there's a chance it could be more useful as energy for the muscles. Okay. Not looking for muscle protein synthesis, not looking at the discharge via urine. We're just saying, if I add protein, can it fuel my muscle? And then the carbohydrate ingestion absorption rates, we've already talked about those. The ingestion 2.4 seems to be the high end, right? The research seems to say 144 grams per hour is where the limit seems to reside right now. But again, don't get lost on that figure because it's the oxidation rate that matters. Getting it in there is only so important if your muscles can only oxidize. And it seems like the high end of things is about 1.8 grams per minute, or roughly 110 grams of carbohydrate per hour. So 110, you can take in 140, 150, 160, but what your muscles can utilize is probably far less than that. So our muscles already maxing out the oxidation rate regardless of this macronutrient combination. Again, that is the question that I can't answer. And then finally, on the inclusion of fat, we talked about this in the previous question. Fat can delay glucose appearance in the blood. It impedes absorption. That's not desirable when you're trying to get glucose in the blood and to the muscles. Fat can slow the gastric emptying rate. No, that's not desirable either. You don't want food sitting in your gut. You want it processing into the small intestine, into the blood. Simply that fat ingestion or co-ingestion, and this is exogenous. You have to be taking this in. We're not talking about the free fatty acids that are released from your stored adipose. None of that. This is what you're putting in your mouth. It just doesn't partner well with glucose ingestion. And this specifically applies to moderate and high intensity work. Maybe if you're going to be out there and work at 55, 60% of your FTP all day, maybe you can get away with some of these things. I don't know. But again, with fat, there was only 9 or 10 grams of fat in something that was extremely calorically dense. So the advice here would be, if you insist on doing this, experiment carefully, and especially in the context of the intended intensity. If it's going to be high intensity, this probably has no place. Low intensity, maybe you could swing it.
Yeah. Hannah, what are your thoughts? And then I want to go into like kind of like a dovetailing question from this.
Yeah. I mean, I think Chad really nailed all the information behind this. So I would just keep it really simple and say, when I read Pat's question, I see two things specifically. Of one, they say that they've used it to successfully get a ton of calories per bottle. Try to instead focus on carbohydrates rather than just the calories. So when you start looking at potential nutrition things, drinks, look at the carbohydrate content. When you start doing that, you'll notice that these mass gainers aren't so far and away better in the carbohydrate concentration than other things that are actually specifically made for these type of events that you're doing. The next thing I say is you even say you're somewhat concerned about the protein percent. So you probably already know somewhere that it might not be the best thing to be taking in. So I would just counter that with, it's not the best thing to be taking in. I feel pretty confident saying that. That doesn't mean you can't get away with it. As Chad mentioned, maybe for some low intensity things, it might work. But I would just challenge you, why is this the product that you're going for, rather than something else that actually really intentionally is made for these type of events?
Yeah. I mean, there's like a product like Marten, Never Second, those sort of ones that are really, they're either 2-to-1 or 1-to-0.8 glucose to fructose. Endurance is another one. That's Dr. Podlogar's brand. And I think that maybe his has galactose in it too. I could be wrong, but anyways, those are so distilled, right? They're so simple and they're intentionally so, because it's for what the current science tells us, it's what we need to improve performance. And it's none of the extra stuff. And the extra stuff just adds more variables to your stomach. And who knows how that's actually going to affect, like Chad said, there's a difference between ingestion and then going all the way down to oxidation, right? Like they're just going to play a role that likely isn't going to be beneficial, or certainly not as equally beneficial as just having pure carbohydrate that you're taking in. So I look at this and just think, why? And the big concern that I've seen represented from this is athletes have submitted questions, not infrequently, Chad, about should I be taking in protein when I ride to avoid muscle degradation or muscle, basically, you know, using muscle for fuel. And maybe that's why, you know, Pat says to get in a ton of calories per bottle, he's been able to do that, but maybe that's driving part of this decision. Or maybe somebody listening to this is thinking of that, like, oh, I should take in protein because then it'll stop protein or muscle breakdown. That's the theory that's behind that. Yeah. What do you say, Chad?
Maybe, but it's pretty hard to miss that or somehow not come to terms with the fact that endurance performance nutrition has gotten hyper-specialized. I mean, the concern is to get as much carbohydrate, as much processable, usable carbohydrate into a bottle and into the body as possible. So if there were any benefit to adding more protein or adding fat, you can bet researchers and the whoever's doing, you know, Tim Polagar with his endurance product would have looked into this, would be actively testing this, because if there's any, and this is what makes me think that the addition of protein in terms of, you know, additional fuel, not protein degradation, probably doesn't hold any merit, because I feel like they would have tried it by now. They would have, at least in some of their trials, would have added protein to certain mixtures. Sadly, if there is research, I couldn't find it, but I don't see research on that, which says, you know, just because the research didn't make it to print doesn't mean it didn't take place. So maybe they just said, nope, this is a fool's errand. We're just going to concentrate on finding the right mixture of sugars, the right amount of sugars, make it as simple and palatable as possible, and we're good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hannah, do you have any final thoughts on this one?
No, I think it's fully covered. I think exactly Chad's point there is if this was what was best, more people would be using it.
Yeah. Simply put. Yeah. And while that's not like always the case across the board, right? Like we do absolutely in some cases push through dogmatically, with ill intention. Sometimes we do that, but this is a spot where there's a lot of research that has existed and has evolved, and it is continuing to evolve, but there is a ton of research showing this. And so the way I look at this is like,
It's not just there's a ton of research. There's research that is actually reliably, you know, reconstructed reproduced these findings. So it's something that has gotten hit again, and it hasn't really failed the test of reproducibility, high scientific rigor. I mean, those things come about and have to come about over a period of time. And we're looking at, I think Jukendrup started looking at this stuff safely 20 years ago, and it's just stood the test of time and a lot of further research over the course of those couple of decades.
Yep. The way I look at this is, Pat, why are you messing with like the old gasoline and like for the lawnmower that's been in there for, you know, and accumulated whatever sort of stuff? You've got jet fuel, man. Like, run the best stuff. Don't run the not so great stuff, just the stuff your body needs. So, great questions. Submit them once again at trainerroad.com/podcast. This has been great to have y'all on here. If you want to go check out Trainer Road and sign up, you can use the early version of AI FTP detection. I'd recommend you go do that. There have been big improvements over the past week to it that make it even easier to use. And there's constant improvement going on with the team that's working really hard on that feature and on workout levels V2, which is what we call it, but basically the ability to quantify very specifically the load that you do in all of your outside workouts or just non-structured rides, which is super exciting. So check all that out. Go to trainerroad.com and sign up and share this podcast with your friends, and we'll talk to you all next week. Thanks, y'all. Appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.